Hello, this is Randy Thompson sitting in for George Douglas. Welcome to the Triangle Reading Services program, The Week Magazine. Today's reading is from the June 24, 2011 issue of The Week Magazine. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next hour, I shall be reading articles from these nine sections of The Week Magazine. The main stories: Controversy of the Week, People, Briefing, Best Columns the U.S., Talking Points, Health and Science, The Last Word, and Poll Watch. The title for the main story section of The Week magazine this week: Bachman emerges as Romney's top challenger. What happened? Mitt Romney cemented his position as frontrunner in the race for the Republican nomination for president as he and six other candidates jointly assailed President Obama's handling of the economy in the first major debate of the 2012 primary season. Pollsters and pundits overwhelmingly named the former Massachusetts governor the winner of the nationally televised debate in New Hampshire. With a confident and steady performance, Romney argued that his experience as governor and in private business made him best qualified to revive the economy. The overall tone of the two-hour debate was surprisingly friendly, with Romney and his rivals, former Minnesota governor Tim Pawlenty, former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, Representative Michelle Bachman, Newt Gingrich, Representative Ron Paul, and Atlanta businessman Herman Cain, reserving their criticism for the president. What the editorial said: after weeks of being derided by the media as the seven dwarfs, said Investor's Business Daily, the GOP candidates finally got a chance to speak directly to the public on Monday. Our response: game on. The contenders issued coherent and incisive critiques of the Obama administration and gave crisp, thoughtful answers to moderator John King's questions. Though Romney and Bachman arguably shone brighter than the others, all of these candidates have the gravitas and stature to take on the White House's current occupant. But where were the ideas, asked the New York Times? It's easy to make facile attacks on the president's failure to lead, but none of the candidates explained how they'd rescue the economy, reduce the deficit, or conduct foreign policy. All they offered were vague anti-government generalizations. By evening's end, they had melted into an indistinguishable mass of privatizing, tax-cutting opponents of Sharia law, what the columnist said. Mitt Romney may be the presumptive nominee, said Dana Milbank of the New York Post, but the purely by default. He's an incredibly stiff campaigner with a forced cornball sense of humor sure to make people wince. Oh my goodness gracious, ha ha ha. And the party's conservative base either doesn't trust him or hates him outright. The Rush Limbaugh wing won't forgive Romney for his Massachusetts health insurance mandate, and he committed a further heresy when he recently acknowledged that climate change is real. Pawlenty was the debate's biggest loser, said Jonathan S. Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Asked to repeat an earlier attack on Romney's Massachusetts health care plan as Obamacare, Pawlenty displayed an astonishing failure of either nerve or imagination and said he'd been criticizing Obama, not Romney. Pawlenty thus ensured that his main rival left the debate unscathed and guaranteed himself a spot in this field's second tier. Michelle Bachman now takes his place as Romney's chief challenger, said John Nichols in The Nation. The Minnesota congresswoman came across as polished, professional, and powerful, and hijacking the debate to announce her candidacy was a theatrically skilled move worthy of Ronald Reagan. Her policy prescriptions shut down the Environmental Protection Agency and other federal agencies and deregulate all industry are so far to the right, however, that she has little chance of winning a general election. If Romney is to be beaten, said John B. Judas in the New Republic, someone formidable will have to get into the race. Step forward, Rick Perry, said Andrew Malcolm in the Los Angeles Times. The tough-talking governor of Texas admitted this week he was considering a run, and with his strong conservative credentials and stated aversion to Washingtonitis, Perry could give Romney a run for his money. Few Republicans are overwhelmed by the current lineup. Perry could yet be the answer to their prayers. Another main story item entitled Syria versus the Syrians. Thousands of Syrians poured into neighboring Turkey this week, fleeing a scorched earth military campaign that brought new levels of violence to the regime's drive to silence dissent. President Bashar al-Assad's forces used helicopter gunships and indiscriminate shellings by tanks to seize the northern town of Jerz al-Shughrout, a center of pro-democracy movement. Witnesses said hundreds of local men were rounded up as troops burned nearby farms and villages. Among the 8,500 people settling into refugee camps in Turkey were dozens of soldiers who deserted rather than fire on unarmed civilians. Terrible things are being done, said deserter Ismail Sher Salih. I have seen people getting shot for no reason. This could be Syria's tipping point, said the Christian Science Monitor in an editorial. Pro-democracy revolutions often start rolling only when individual soldiers refuse orders to shoot unarmed civilians. Just such a mutiny, in fact, prompted Assad's crackdown in Jisr al-Shughout. But by killing even more civilians in such a wholesale way, the regime may only drive more soldiers to defy their superiors. Why isn't the U.S. helping these brave resistors, asked the Washington Times. Assad's thugs have killed more civilians than Muammar al-Qaddafi did before the U.S. started bombing Libya. Yet President Obama has offered nothing but platitudes to the Syrians. The administration says the key difference is that in Libya there was a U.N. mandate to intervene. Apparently, then, Obama has given the U.N. the implicit veto power to prevent the U.S. from acting in its national interest or defending the helpless. It's not that simple, said Adrian Peraccio in Newsday. Gaddafi's fate affects only Libya, but Assad's fall could sow chaos in Jordan, Iraq, and Lebanon. In the worst scenario, Iran, Syria's ally, could intervene militarily to prop up Assad. That is why Obama and his allies have decided that the devil they know in Syria is still preferable to an unknown alternative. But their misguided restraint is short-sighted, said Frieda Gittes in the Miami Herald. Just last week, Assad sent protesters pouring into the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. If his brutality against the Syrian people was not enough, his willingness to trigger another regional war should convince the international community to get serious about engineering Assad's removal now, before it's too late. And this final main story entry, Weiner pressured to quit. Representative Anthony Weiner faced mounting pressure to resign this week over his sexting scandal, as both President Obama and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi called on him to step down for the good of the Democratic Party. I can tell you that it was me, I would resign, Obama said in a televised interview. Obama called the lewd photos and message Weiner sent to at least a dozen women highly inappropriate, and joined Pelosi in pressuring a congressman to quit so as to spare his family and the party further embarrassment. Democratic leaders were reported to be hopeful that Weiner's wife, Huma Abedin, might persuade her husband to resign, despite his earlier insistence that he stay on after he completed treatment for sex addiction. Abedin returned Wednesday from a week-long trip to Africa with her boss, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. What exactly should Anthony Weiner resign? Asked Peter Beinhardt in the DailyBeast.com. Yes, he indulged in some dorky and easily traceable flirting and then lied about it, like married men usually do in such circumstances, but he didn't break any laws, and he's still popular in his home district in Queens and Brooklyn, where a poll finds that 56% of voters don't think he should quit. That's not surprising, said Victor Camber in Politico.com, because Weiner is a top-notch congressman. Republicans are gleeful because he's been such an effective critic of their cookie policies on Medicare, health care, and taxes. I only wish some of the Democrats now urging him to resign would stand up for their party's ideals the way he does. Ideals? Said Dennis Prager in National Review. Weiner has disgraced himself and his office, and he should quit for the good of the country as a whole, especially young people. Ask any teenager whether they'd be more humiliated to discover that their father had had an affair or had sent photos of his penis to young women he never met. As long as Weiner remains a congressman, he makes every one of his colleagues look bad. And that brings us to the next section of The Week magazine, Controversy of the Week. Cybersex, will it make monogamy obsolete? He never touched another woman and claims to be happily married, yet for years he's been conducting virtual affairs through Facebook, Twitter, and texting. Just how unusual is Anthony Weiner's New York scandal-plagued Democratic congressman? Asked Tracy Clark Flory in Salon.com. Not very. In a brave new world of online porn and instant internet connectivity, millions of other men, and yes, women, are exploring the countless new avenues for extramarital adventures. Like it or not, technology has forever changed the landscape of intimacy and fidelity, and is now forcing us to reassess our traditional concepts of monogamy. Does sexting count as adultery? Or are these virtual dalliances with strangers we'll never meet just a harmless form of online entertainment? These are questions we're just now beginning to consider, said Andrew Sullivan in thedailybeast.com. For the first time in human history, the Internet enables people to create an alternative sexual reality where they can exist as a body without a head or a mind, a pair of strained underpants, or even as an avatar with a whole new identity. We haven't quite figured out how to square this with our other lives. In the past, infidelity was fraught with the possibility of destructive consequences, including sexually transmitted diseases and unwanted pregnancies. Not so if you cheat through an online sex chat or a pornographic webcam. These activities are so wildly popular, especially among people under 35, because they allow otherwise monogamous individuals to let off some steam. What's so terrible about that? Said Jessica Bennett, also in thedailybeast.com. A recent survey found that 65% of women and a whopping 80% of men say they'd cheat if they knew they wouldn't get caught. It's simply unreasonable to expect one person to fulfill your every need, sexual or otherwise, through decades of marriage. Cybersex is just one of the many ways modern couples are seeking a little extra on the side. That doesn't mean the end of marriage, but it may mean we have to revise the rules. If you think online sex isn't real, said William Salatin of TheSlate.com, you're fooling yourself. The Internet creates an illusion of anonymity among its users, making them think of online affairs as a kind of game disconnected from reality. That was the rationalization Weiner himself used to excuse his sexting, and as he said in his defense, I never met these women. I never really had much desire to. But what he called his communications turned into real online relationships, rife with intimate exchanges and sexual expression, which he pursued addictively and recklessly. Weiner's pregnant wife is now heartsick, and his career is in tatters. Sounds pretty real to me. But what a strange kind of reality it is, said Ross do that in the New York Times. As Weiner has reminded us, cyber sex isn't about relationships at all, or even about sex. It's about narcissism in its most desperate and adolescent form. You don't tweet photos of your penis or artsy shots of your gym-sculpted pecs because you're fascinated with the women on the other end. You send them because you're fascinated with yourself. Narcissism, of course, existed long before Facebook and Twitter, but social media serve as a hall of mirrors in which it flourishes as never before. In this obsessive new realm, the real thrill comes not from talking dirty, but from the chance to say over and over, "Look at me. Look at me." And what about good week, bad week? Well, it was a good week for Charles Futrelle, a 90-year-old Floridian, who became the oldest man to complete a sanctioned triathlon when he swam 440 yards, biked 10 miles, and ran 3 miles in 2 hours and 18 minutes. Proceeding with caution. After Tweet Congress, a group that monitors Twitter traffic on Capitol Hill, said that the number of tweets sent by members of Congress had suddenly dropped 28%. Crystal Harris, 25, the latest large-breasted blonde to be courted by Hugh Hefner after she called off their marriage just 5 days before she was to wed the Viagra-fueled 85-year-old creator of Playboy. Crystal has had a change of heart. Side Hef. Meanwhile, it was a bad week for Macy's and the Miami Herald after the newspaper ran an ad from the retailer congratulating the Miami Heat for winning the NBA Finals. The ad, offering commemorative Heat t-shirts and hats, ran on the same sports page as a story detailing the Heat's crushing defeat by the Dallas Mavericks. Getting invited to dinner. After 15% of people admitted in a British survey to serving guests food that had fallen on the floor. And then finally, fans of lesbian bloggers. After the author of the celebrated Gay Girl in Damascus blog acknowledged that, in fact, he is a married American man who made it all up. A day later, the editor of lesbian news site Les Get Real, a gay girl's view of the world, admitted he was a 58-year-old retired military man. And that brings us to our people section. First article, Olbermann's next move. Keith Olbermann doesn't plan to go away quietly, said Mark Benelli in Rolling Stone. It's been 6 months since the abrasive liberal talk show host left MSNBC abruptly amid speculation that he'd been fired. Olbermann, 52, says that he was actually happy to go and that his relationship with network executives had been deteriorating ever since Meet the Press host Tim Russert, an NBC heavyweight, died 3 years ago. One of the reasons I got as far as I got was that Tim was there to run interference for me, Olbermann says. He probably was my biggest supporter within the network. Later this month, Olbermann will debut a new show on Al Gore's Current TV, which now averages a mere 23,000 viewers in prime time. People think he was sent into the wilderness, Olbermann says, but they're wrong. His new network will flourish because it is free of the commercial pressures that made NBC and its corporate overlords tire of the controversy he stirred up. I view this as the biggest step up of my career, Olbermann says. It will be that simple kind of old-fashioned television news operation of the 60s and 70s that had the proverbial Chinese walls around them to keep them away from concerns about advertisers. We're going to take MSNBC's business away from them. That's the idea. Do it better. This idea gives him a smile of satisfaction. They thought I was going to go away for so long that nobody would bring me back. The man who was cured of HIV. Timothy Brown can actually say he was cured of AIDS, says Tina Rosenberg in New York. When Brown, 45, was diagnosed as HIV positive in 1995, his former partner told him, "You've probably only got 2 years to live, But in the nick of time, the development of antiretroviral therapies extended his life. 10 years later, he again began to feel weak. Tests revealed that he had leukemia. Devastated, he began seeing a cancer doctor named Jero Hutter, who had a bold idea. Hutter knew that only a bone marrow transplant would cure the leukemia. What he could find, a donor with a rare genetic mutation called Delta 32, which makes a person practically immune to HIV. Such a donor was found, and after 2 transplants, Brown's leukemia and HIV infection both disappeared. The treatment is impractical on a grand scale, but Brown's case has revived hopes for a cure. It's an incredible feeling, like a miracle, says Brown. I had 2 lethal diseases and was able to get rid of both of them. And finally, a Dutch's tale. Sarah Ferguson is trying to halt her long fall from grace, said Laura M. Holson in the New York Times. The past year has been particularly bad for the Duchess of York. She was caught trying to sell access to her former husband, Prince Andrew, for $40,000, nearly went bankrupt, and was denied an invitation to the royal wedding of Prince William and Catherine Middleton. At 51, she's candid about how far she's fallen. Recently, she found herself trying to earn a bit of money by giving a motivational speech at a remote resort in Edmonton, Alberta. It was a casino in the middle of nowhere, she says. I got to the tent, and because of the pouring rain, only 8 people showed up. I had gone from marrying the Queen's son to being in a tent in the middle of nowhere with 8 people in the audience. I'd got down to bowling alleys. The wedding snub was a reminder that the fairy tale, as she calls it, truly is over. Yet, that also means, she says, she's now free to reinvent herself as something more than an ex-royal. With Catherine going up the aisle, you know what went through my head? I feel like I've handed her the baton and said, well done, and you'll do all right. I didn't do it right, and now I'm going to go with Sarah, right? And the next section of the Week magazine briefing, Israel's hardliner-in-chief. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's wariness about compromising with the Palestinians has deep roots. Is Netanyahu opposed to a Palestinian state? Not in theory. He says he'd like to see a 2-state solution, but only if Palestinians first recognize Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state, renounce any right of return, and agree to Israel's control of East Jerusalem, the Golan Heights, and much of the West Bank. He also refuses to negotiate with the Palestinians if Hamas, the radical organization that controls the Gaza Strip, is in any way involved. In effect, this means there is no chance for negotiations, which is fine by Netanyahu, because he believes that relinquishing territory will only weaken Israel. I think anyone with eyes in his head understands that today. Any territory you evacuate will be taken over by Israel's bitterest foes, he said on the eve of his 2009 election. How did he come to that view? It's partly bred in the bone. His father is Benzion Netanyahu, a former Cornell University historian and a militant advocate of revisionist Zionism, which holds that Israel should return to its historical borders from biblical times. Since Israel was founded in 1948, Benzion has opposed all concessions to the Palestinians. He says Arabs, by nature, are inescapable of any compromise or agreement, and that there is no solution but force. Many Israelis believe Netanyahu remains, in the words of Israeli peace advocate Gershon Baskin, bound by the echoing voice of his father. Isn't that ancient history? Hardly. Benzion, still spry at 101, remains a powerful presence in his son's life. At his 100th birthday party, Benzion said, "The nation of Israel is showing the world today how a state should behave when it stands before an existential threat by looking danger in the eye. One person present told journalist Jeffrey Goldberg, this was the father giving his son's histories marching orders, and that Netanyahu was completely absorbed. Many believe that while Ben-Zion remains alive, the prime minister will not cede any territory because he would look weak in his father's eyes. So filial loyalty alone drives him? No. His politics have been informed by bitter personal experience, too. As a member of the Sayeret Matkal, an elite special operations unit, Netanyahu helped rescue a hijacked jet plane at the Tel Aviv airport in 1972, and he fought in the 1973 Yom Kippur War. But the operation that marked him the most was one he did not participate in. In 1976, a radical Palestinian group hijacked an airplane, diverted it to Entebbe, Uganda, and threatened to kill the Jewish passengers unless Palestinian prisoners were released. Netanyahu's older brother, Jonathan, also a member of Sayeret Matkal, was killed while leading a daring and successful raid in Uganda to free the hostages. I will be inspired until the end of my days, just as I was inspired in my youth by the strength and courage of my brother, Netanyahu said in 2006. Is he popular in Israel? His hardline views have gone in and out of favor several times. In 1996, following Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin's assassination at the hand of a fanatical Israeli far-right winger and a series of suicide bombers by Palestinian militants, Netanyahu narrowly beat incumbent Shimon Peres to become the youngest Israeli prime minister at age 46. He significantly slowed Israeli troop withdrawals mandated by the 1993 Oslo Accords from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and announced new Jewish settlements in the West Bank. More suicide bombings ensued. In 1998, Netanyahu agreed under pressure from then-President Bill Clinton to the Y River Memorandum, which was to place nearly half of the West Bank under Palestinian control. That concession angered far-right parties, which quit Netanyahu's governing coalition, triggering new elections that Netanyahu lost to Labour's Ehud Barak. War hero Ariel Sharon replaced him as head of the Likud, Israel's major right-wing party. Having his positions changed in his current term? Formally, yes, practically not so much. Sharon eventually split from Likud to form the centrist Kadima party, leaving Netanyahu in charge of a more conservative Likud. In the 2009 election, Netanyahu was able to attract enough support from smaller far-right parties to create a coalition majority and become prime minister. Afterward, he said for the first time that he would accept Palestinian statehood, although with major caveats. No right of return for Palestinian refugees and no control of East Jerusalem. Since then, he has continued to support settlement building in the West Bank and expansions of apartment complexes in East Jerusalem. He's now pushing back hard against President Obama's call for Israel to cede land won in the 1967 Six-Day War as a starting point for new talks. How does that play in Israel? Generally well. Israelis remain divided on whether to trade land for peace, but many Israelis have moved to the right out of frustration with the Palestinian leadership, repeated rocket attacks on Israeli civilians, and the failure of previous negotiations. When Netanyahu angrily told President Obama last month that Israel would never return to the indefensible 1967 borders, his approval rating at home rose 13 percentage points to 51%. Brings us to the next section of the Week magazine, Best Columns, the U.S. How Obesity Drives Up the Debt. This is by David Stipe of MillerMcCoon.com. Don't blame all senior citizens for causing Medicare costs to skyrocket, said David Stape. Blame the obese. In the ongoing debate about Medicare, pundits and politicians often succumb to the mass hallucination that by living longer, old people run up the big medical bills. In reality, people who are healthy at age 70 live an average of 14 more years, spending less than $10,000 a year each on medical care. The real cost threat to Medicare comes from people who enter old age with serious weight problems. In the past, obesity doomed you to an early death, but today, cholesterol-cutting medicine and diabetes drugs keep unhealthy people alive into their 70s and even early 80s at enormous cost. The annual medical bills of obese Americans are 42% higher than average because they're more susceptible to heart disease, diabetes, cancer, and even dementia. From an economist's point of view, tens of millions of pot-bellied boomers entering their Medicare years is not a pretty sight. If our society is serious about trimming future budget deficits, we'll first have to trim our swelling waistlines. And then there's this article by James Taranto, The Wall Street Journal. Liberals, too, can be hypocrites. At least Anthony Weiner isn't a hypocrite. That said, James Taranto is the rationalization many liberals are using to differentiate the virtual sexual transgressions of Democratic New York congressmen from what they call family values moralizers. But does that mean that liberal Democrats have no moral standards to violate? Of course they do. Virtually all liberals, all Weiner included, profess to be feminist, adamantly opposed to the subjugation of women as sex objects. Weiner, for example, once demanded that a sexist statue he removed from a public park in Queens because it depicted a muscular hero being tempted by two female sirens. In his public life, he was a model feminist. After all, he married Huma Abedin, a high-powered aide to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. But in his virtual life, he was a closet sexist pig, aggressively sending pictures of his private parts to deferential female admirers and addressing them like cheap whores. How exactly does that make him different from a family values conservative who turns out to be struggling with homosexual desires? And then there's this piece by Betty Rowland from the Los Angeles Times, A Second Look at Death with Dignity. Now that Jack Kevorkian is gone, the Death with Dignity movement has a new opportunity, said Betty Rowland. Kevorkian, who died 2 weeks ago, was not a humanitarian, but an egotistical ghoul who seemed to enjoy putting people to death. He actually set back the cause of those of us who seek to change state laws so that terminally ill people can gain some control over their final days. 3 decades ago, when the final stages of ovarian cancer left my mother racked with nausea and pain, she asked for help in ending her own life. Reluctantly, I obtained lethal medication, and it seemed to wipe away her terror. She used those pills only when her suffering became unbearable. Opponents have waged powerful campaigns of disinformation against death with dignity laws, contending they would open the doors to widespread euthanasia. But in Oregon and Washington, the only 2 states to legalize assisted suicide, there has been no slippery slope. Only a few dozen people a year have chosen to end their own lives, and all were in the final stages of horrific diseases. Helping suffering people is not murder. It's about compassion, freedom, and common sense. And that takes us to the section of the Week magazine called The Last Word. What My Father Taught Me. Dads Help Shape Us and 4 contributors to the radio series This I Believe describe how. This is excerpt from permission of the publisher, Josie Bass, a Wiley imprint from This I Believe on Fatherhood, edited by Dan Gediman, 2011, by This I Believe, Incorporated. My father's hands. When I think of my father, I remember his hands, liver-spotted and dexterous, hands that tied flies and built wooden toys for children at Christmas. Those hands that palm my chest and stomach when I learned to swim now cannot break free of the bed rails or of the esophageal cancer that slowly strangles him. It is late March 2006, and his nurse has tied my father's hands to steel bed rails so that, in his morphine-induced state, he won't pull out his IV. Needle pricks from 3 weeks in the hospital have left the backs of his hands bruised and yellowed. I look at his hands and remember how strong they used to be, how so many things I know how to do came from watching his hands. My father was a teacher. Not by trade, but by nature. He understood the catchphrase, teachable moment, better than most educators. I am 5 or 6, freezing in an ice shack on the Kennebec River, smelt sizzling in a frying pan close by. His hands busy tying flies. He says, "You should help one person each day." Years later, in the front yard, with a rake in his hand, he tells me, "Marry your best friend, son." That's what I did. The lectures didn't end when I grew up, either. I even looked forward to his monthly phone calls, sure to find a lesson somewhere. He would make sure I was replacing the windows the right way, or make sure I was not turning into one of those awful Little League parents. I would groan, "Dad, I'm 35, and you still need a lecture?" He'd say, "Sad, isn't it?" His most important lesson didn't come as a lecture. My sister and I stand in the hallway awaiting Dad's return from the X-ray lab. They have taken him off the ventilator to see if the mechanical breathing apparatus allowed his lungs to rest and heal to where he can breathe on his own. We are praying for a miracle. At the sound of a bed coming towards us, wheels grinding dully, we look up. Dad raises his hand and the nurse stops pushing the bed. My chest gets tighter when I look down at him. He's bald, his eyes sunken. A month earlier, my daughters, age 8 and 5, did not immediately recognize him. "How are you doing?" As stupid as that question is, I can think of nothing else. "It could be worse," he says. "It could be worse?" I repeat. "Dad, how the hell could this get any worse?" "There was a little girl from the children's cancer floor coming out of the X-ray when I went in," he said simply. "Looked like my granddaughter. That would be worse." I will sit with Dad during his final night, the distance between him and me widening like gaps between his final sandpaper breaths. At 7 a.m., the nurse will say the obvious, and I will look toward the ceiling as if watching Dad drive away after visiting his grandchildren. Only this time, there will be no wave, just a disjointed feeling of permanence. I believe dignity may be the most challenging attribute a parent can pass on to their child, dying with it, even more so. When the nurse wheels the bed away, Dad's hands are no longer tied down. Now they are folded peacefully across his chest. That's by John R. Corrigan. Then there's the letter in my locker. I wrote a letter to my kids a few years ago. It's 3 pages long, and it sums up what I've learned in 4 decades of life. My kids are too young to understand now, but by the time they reach adulthood, they will have heard most of the advice in that letter. Live in the moment. Do not attach yourself to physical things. Treat others the way you would like to be treated. Find happiness in the service of others. Make the most out of today. Follow your dreams. Don't take yourself too seriously. Be aware that there are hypocrites and manipulators in the world, etc. I sealed the letter in a plain white envelope and wrote instructions not to open it unless something horrible happened to me. A. Marvin, the Martian magnate, holds it to the side of my musty gray metal locker at work. It is surrounded by police uniforms, spare change, tribute of mourning ribbons for my badge to honor fallen colleagues, pictures of my kids, the Far Side cartoons, poems, scraps of paper with handwritten notes, business cards, dust and lint, remnants of almost 20 years of serving others. As a police officer, I've seen life snuffed out or irrevocably changed in an instant. I realize that could happen to me at any time. Yet, knowing that letter is there in my locker makes me feel more comfortable with my own mortality. If something does happen to me, my children will get that letter. In it, they will read about my love for them and about the advice that I want to pass on to them when they are old enough to understand it. Every day when I open my locker, I see the letter. It reminds me to be careful at work and to show my children and the people I come into contact with that I truly understand and practice everything I've written. If that day comes and my children finally read the letter, I hope that because of my actions, they will take my written beliefs to heart and improve upon my example. But for me, it's not enough to write down my beliefs. I try to be the best person I can be every day, even in very difficult circumstances, even with offensive people. I'm more successful some days than others. I curse too much sometimes. I'm cynical. I don't go to church as often as I should. I also get depressed, yell at my kids occasionally, and sometimes I'm not as loving or as compassionate as I should be. In fact, I am far from perfect, but I hope my children will eventually realize that perfection is an illusion. What really matters is that instead of just writing about our beliefs, we all take action to be the best humans we can be. That's by Tim Wilson. The next entry is entitled My Father's Lectures. My father wasn't a spanker, a shouter, a poker, or a grounder. He was a lecturer. When he really got into it, I swear, he channeled another dimension, some celestial debating hall, in which Pericles and William James presented their cases before a council of mathematicians with the legendary Rabbi Hillel presiding. His timing was brilliant, too. When I got a C in math, he waited to give me the talk until we were in a moving car so that I had nowhere to run. Of course, it wasn't a confrontation at all, and how much easier a confrontation would have been than the reasoned interlocution that ensued. When I want to convey my admiration of him, I tell a true story of a lecture so short it barely deserves a title. I came home from middle school and mentioned that one of the few black kids on the playground got picked on that day. I'd even heard the N-word for the first time. Dad asked if I told a teacher, and I said no. I was just glad they weren't picking on me. No, he said, and his voice was soft. This was different. Do your homework. This was not. Whenever you hear nigger, hear dirty Jew, whenever you hear spick or fag or dyke, hear dirty Jew, and take it personally. Those words have had an enormous impact on me. They have helped to define the person I strive to become, and so they have become the go-to story, the story of a simple lecture of justice and moral clarity. But over the years, I've come to appreciate the longer lectures, too, those knots of on the one hands and on the others I so hated as an adolescent. But nowadays, I mostly find myself shaped by convoluted auxiliary points, by caveats and nuances. Like my father, I have become a collector of alternative angles, finding sanitary in interminable deliberation. Dad doesn't care about my old math grades anymore. In truth, I'm not sure he ever did. It was the process he was pressing into my mind, the process of living as an impromptu lecturer. I believe in dissecting consequences, analyzing obstacles, considering possibilities, making a plan, and doing it all now, in the moving car, without notes or preparations, whether you like it or not, because life isn't as easy as getting grounded or spanked, and there's an awful lot we have to talk through. That's by Seth Chalmer. And the final entry from this I Believe series, entitled The Dads We Are Given. My dad did not contribute physically to my creation. I was adopted when I was 3 months old. He did not want me at first. He told my mom he was not comfortable taking on somebody else's kid. He felt tremendous guilt because a genetic condition rendered him sterile and unable to give my mother the children they both so deeply desired. My dad finished high school and apprenticed in a machine shop at the Washington Navy Yard. When I was in elementary school, he transferred to the Goddard Space Flight Center, where he made parts for the moon buggy and the Hubble Space Telescope. He was a hard worker. After the idea of being an adoptive father took root, he was a great dad. He chatted with everyone, a trait that caused me great embarrassment when I was a teenager. He would strike up conversations in line at the grocery store, in the seats at the movie theater, and at all the campgrounds we ever frequented. Once, while we were visiting a small airport, my dad talked a local pilot into giving me a ride in his airplane. I'm amazed that he trusted a complete stranger enough to let me go, but he did. He never said no when I tested my own wings, whether somersaulting on the front lawn or taking off in the family station wagon to go to college 4 states away. Then there was the time our next-door neighbor's house caught fire. My brother, who was also adopted, saw the flames and woke him. Dad told my mom to call the fire department, and then we went next door to help. He opened the front door and called out. Our neighbors answered, but Dad could not see her because of the thick smoke. So Dad stretched out on the floor with his feet hooked on the door frame and kept calling for her to come toward his voice. Eventually he felt her hand and pulled her out of the burning, smoke-filled home. He stayed to assist the firemen when they came, and only after my mom pointed out that he was only wearing his skivvies did he go home. My dad fixed things. He fixed the car when it broke down. He repaired the hot water heater when it stopped making hot water. He kissed skinned knees and mended the skateboards that caused them. I don't remember anything he couldn't fix except maybe his own appetite for good food and the brainstem stroke that took him in his 64th year. As I said goodbye to him in the neurology ICU, I told him that I loved him. I told him that I didn't need to find my real parents because he and Mom were my real parents. I thanked him for being my dad. This is by Kathy Wells McMenamin. And that takes us to Talking Points. Issue of the week. Debit card fees. Who will get the bill for lower transaction fees? Regrettably, round one on debit card fees goes to the government, said Bloomberg.com in an editorial. Despite an elaborate, expensive, and sometimes disingenuous lobbying campaign, the banking industry couldn't convince the Senate last week to turn back a key provision of last year's Dodd-Frank financial reform law. As of July 21, the Federal Reserve will start capping transaction fees at 12 cents, down from an average now at 44 cents per sale. Their shenanigans aside, the big banks were right to oppose the measure. Why in the world should the government set the price for using a debit card? We usually let the market itself set prices, an arrangement that works pretty well. But instead of just making that honest argument, the banks conjured up plagues of locusts and lost. Why don't they think they've actually given up, said David Benoit in WSJ.com. Last week, the industry said it would probably take its battle to the courts. There, its lawyers will argue that the Fed had misinterpreted the law by applying a hard cap on fees, and that the cap it imposed is illegally low. The banks can expect the same vigorous opposition from the retail lobby that they faced in the Senate, said Edward Wyatt in the New York Times. Retailers paid more than $20 billion last year to the largest debit card networks, Visa and MasterCard, and are happy to be rid of that burden. Just as the banks claimed the new rules would harm little banks and bolster giant retail companies, retailers framed the debate as pitting J.P. Morgan Chase Bank of America and Wells Fargo against mom-and-pop stores. It's not clear how much Main Street four storefronts will save from the new law, but Home Depot stands to pocket $35 million a year. But what about the rest of us? Asked Blake Jones in the Glens Falls, New York Post-Star. The vote was a win for retailers, but it's less clear what the impact will be for consumers. Sure, maybe retailers will pass along some of their windfall, but banks are almost certain to look for new ways to make up for the drop-off in debit transaction revenue. Free checking accounts may be one step closer to extinction, said Candace Choi in the Associated Press. Some other possible results: higher ATM fees, fewer debit card rewards, even caps on debit card transactions. In other words, the consumer could be the loser after all. And that takes us to Health and Science, an article entitled, What Wrinkles Reveal? Feeling the wrinkles in your face may be enough to gauge how likely you are to suffer bone fractures as you age. A new Yale University study shows that the deeper a middle-aged woman's facial wrinkles appear, the weaker her bones are. Researchers tested postmenopausal women in their late 40s and early 50s and found a link between wrinkles and osteoporosis, regardless of whether the women smoked, took vitamins, exposed themselves to the sun, or were overweight. The reason may turn out to be that firm skin and strong bones are both built by collagen, a protein our body begins to lose as we get older. Study author Lubna Pal taught ABCNews.com that confirming a link between wrinkles and bone health could help doctors identify and treat osteoporosis among older patients. The condition currently requires an expensive diagnostic test, so it often goes unnoticed until a person breaks a hip or a leg. But if things on the outside of us can indicate a risk to things inside, Pal says, osteoporosis may not be quite a silent disease. And then there's this section called It Wasn't All Bad. Whatever else he did, 10-year-old Tom Phillips knew he wasn't allowed to drive the tractor at his family farm in Abergavenny in southern Wales. But when he saw his father under attack from a 2,000-pound bull, he figured it was time to break the rules. Tom started up the tractor and used it to nudge the angry beast away. His father was rushed to the hospital and is recovering from 10 broken ribs. I was a bit worried about driving the tractor, Tom said, but I just did what I had to do. I'm glad my dad is going to be all right. Talk about starting over. Sue Meck of Gaithersburg, Maryland, was struck in the temple by a dislodged ceiling fan 23 years ago. The injury caused advanced retrograde amnesia, leaving the then 22-year-old woman unable to read, write, or even recognize her husband and child. But decades of hard work rebuilding her abilities paid off last month when she graduated with honors from Montgomery College. For years, she said, I was a parent, I was a wife, but I didn't have anything by myself, no more. She will continue her studies at Smith College in the fall. And finally, construction worker Mike Tresiak of Jackson, Michigan, heard his neighbor Timothy Kirkland scream for help when a jack slipped and left him trapped beneath the minivan he had been working under. Tresiak ran over, grabbed the front of the van, was able to lift it enough for Kirkland's son to pull him out. Kirkland is now recovering in the hospital. It's not Superman, said Tresiak. I do construction, so guess I'm a little stronger than most people. And under the section, it must be true, I read it in the tabloids. Australian police have caught a one-legged burglar by following the trail of one-legged footprints. David Phillips, 44, was tracked after burglarizing a series of homes. It was not the hardest series of crimes to solve, as he cuts a pretty distinctive figure with one leg, said a police spokesman. By the time he left a trail in the mud, even Inspector Clouseau might have managed to collar him. And what about this? The staff at a Goodwill store in Fenton, Michigan, are trying to find the person who donated an urn containing Grandma's ashes in a pile of donations. The staff recently found a box labeled Grandma's Urn, and in it a sealed vase containing human remains. It's got to be the number one or two weirdest items we've ever received, said manager Alan Reichman. He suspects the ashes were donated inadvertently as part of a house clean-out. And under poll watch, 57% of Americans say politicians get caught in sex scandals because they are under greater scrutiny. 19% say it's because politicians have lower moral standards than ordinary Americans. That's from Pew Research Center, Washington Post. 50% of Republicans say they would prefer that their party's presidential nominee be the person with the best chance of beating President Obama. That's 50% of them. But 44% say they would prefer someone who shares their views on the issues they care most about. That from the USA Today Gallup poll. And under wit and wisdom, this from Stephen Ambrose, quoted in the Wall Street Journal, God created man with a penis and a brain, but only gave him enough blood to run one at a time. And Will Rogers, quoted in the New York Post, when Congress makes a joke, it's a law, and when they make a law, it's a joke. And finally, under wit and wisdom, is this quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson, quoted in Forbes.com. Happiness is a perfume you cannot pour on others without getting a few drops on yourself. And under the section called The Bottom Line, we see this entry. Walmart is launching an online grocery delivery service called Walmart To Go that will sell food, health and beauty products, medicine, and other grocery items. Delivery fees are around $5, and the minimum order is $49. This is from DailyFinance.com. And this item from the Wall Street Journal. For the first time, IBM may name a woman to its chief executive post. She's sales chief Virginia M. Romerty, a 53-year-old who has spent 3 decades at the company. We've run out of time for today's reading of The Week magazine. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, filling in for George Douglas, who will return next week for TRRS. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.